That's Mo Horizons with Do the Boogaloo. Yes, I'm going to personally take on this challenge to bring back the boogaloo, the shingaling, the mashed potato, and other things like that. Would you believe that that is music coming out of Hanover, Germany, from the group Mo Horizons? Since 1999, they've been putting out all kinds of retro rhythm music. And it's fun to revisit that kind of music. Of course, we know that the king of boogaloo came from the Bronx. I'm talking about Pete Rodriguez. And I wonder if he's still around. I know he is, but it would be great to know that he, too, is reintroducing the boogaloo, the Latin boogaloo, which is what took flight many years ago. This is Lead Stories. I'm Retrice Lead. It is Free Your Mind Friday. And that means you get to detox and declutter before the weekend so you can have a nice, peaceful weekend and those around you will connect with you in more human terms. You can't walk around with all of this political baggage. You really have to get rid of it somehow. Well, let's get started. 888-874-4888. What's on your mind? What do you want to free your mind of today? Harvey from Berkeley. Good to hear from you.
Hello, wonderful Utrice.
Hello, Harvey. How are you doing?
Very good. And I have some good news. Yes, it's that time of year again. It's National Back Rub Day, the day after taxes. It's a day when consenting adults all around America can help each other reduce the stresses of paying taxes and share neck rubs and family members, friends, everybody. When I go to the local cafe, I share neck rubs with other people in a safe environment. Everybody's fully clothed and it's a wonderful experience. And it's also a celebration of our quantum entanglement heritage. And so I feel that this is a good time to get back in touch, to stay in touch. And actually, we live in a kind of a touchless society. In fact, people apologize when they touch each other. And I feel that that's part of our problem because we're fed such a diet of a separation of the, you know, it's always the other. And we're kind of like conditioned to to hate each other. And I feel that it's getting in touch with neck rubs in a safe environment or shoulder rubs is a way for us to actually get back physically in touch with each other and start reconnecting, because there's so many forces that are at play here to make us all separate and think of each other as the enemy and to kill the other. And so, you know, just open up any paper. So I say this is a good holiday. So many holidays are based on war or strife, and this one is about connection. So it's National Back Rub Day, the day after taxes, April 16th, and I want to tell everybody that to get back in touch. Yeah.
Thanks, Carvey. Thanks for getting us started today. From Philadelphia, Clara, you on the air.
Hello, Beatrice. Thank you for letting me on again. I wanted to tell you how much I appreciated your talk on yesterday. I think it was in response to Senator McCloskey's speech.
Yes.
It was superb. I'm telling you, I had the benefit of hearing two outstanding talks in the same week. I heard Cornel West. He was speaking at a church in New Jersey, and it was put on the Black Agenda. It was on Monday, yeah. So both mm-hmm. of them, I put them both really up high in my experiences. I wanted to also respond to the man. I don't know his name. I think when I think of him, I don't know his name, so I didn't hear the beginning of his call. I think of him as that sage on Utrecht's program. He spoke at length, so I got to hear probably the last half. He was talking about personal responsibility and community action. He was followed by Sarah, who had a similar message, and I really appreciated both of them, because it fed into my thinking about what I plan to do, and I hope might inspire other people. I've thought of a way where I might be able to bring people together and help them to change their perspectives on their own power. In Philadelphia, we have a system called the block system. We have a block officers, and you can volunteer, block captains, and we can volunteer. And not too many people want to do it, so it's kind of open. And I would have, if I became a block captain, I'd have the opportunity to shape my role within, you know, to a large extent. And I see it as a possible organizing position in which I could organize. So that I just thought that other people might think in terms of that, since we're beginning to look at local ways mm-hmm. of change. Mm-hmm. So that's what I wanted to say.
Well, thank you so much. And it is a very good idea. That is at the real micro level of making a difference. When you start at your block, you're starting literally at home base, and mm-hmm. you have the ability to connect with people with on the basis of shared interests. Right away, they get to understand where you are, and you get to understand where they are. And it is about the vitality of the community. And so that is what informs people's actions. I saw that take place to incredible effect on a block in Brooklyn. It was just one block at the time on State Street in downtown Brooklyn, where it was a community with great potential, but besieged by, just every imaginable, every vice you want to think of. The people on the block it was chaotic. Life became even more so when the sun went down. And little by little, you saw flowers appearing all over the place. And people were cultivating these flowers. And the block started to literally bloom. And it became a symbol of how, when people take an interest at that level, they don't have to scream and get into big-time warfare. They just signal that this is not the place for you. We have an entirely different concept about our block. We're not disengaged or disconnected from each other. We share the common view that where we live is worth protecting, and worth holding on to. And it spread to other blocks to the point where several blocks on State Street were designated the most beautiful blocks in Brooklyn. And high on the list of transformation by people who made up their minds, look, I live here, my roots are here, my children are here, and because I live here, I have a vested interest. And that changed the entire thinking of several other blocks. So that's great to get involved at that level. Thank you, Clara. Thanks so much
Thank
for that.
Thank you.
Hello, Dan from California. Where are you?
Hello, this is Utrecht.
Hello.
And greetings on this beautiful day. I'm up by Mount Shasta. And this second time I've got a chance to speak with you, and I'm very thrilled with that.
Thank you.
Free My Mind Friday. I don't know if Friday's enough time, but there are a couple of things that I would like to, upset me a little bit. One of them being, two things, and I'll be very brief, is because I do have a tendency to go on and on, but two of them are very race-related prejudice, and it has to do with people having the idea that Barack Obama was the first American president without really looking into it, and if they did, they'd find that the first president of the United States was a black man. And as a matter of fact, he was elected by the Congress, and no one opposed him, no one ran against him, because it was such a mess at that time. I think George Washington was a dozen people after that. But another issue has to do with the disparity between people being held in prison, say, for drug charges, the large percentage, very large percentage of them being black youth and peoples, and people find that to be a very alarming, and we have a tendency to have very short memories in America. I think it's one of the blessings, I guess. But originally in 37, when the prohibition, the tax, Marijuana Tax Act was put in place, it was driven by prejudice. The entire thing, we've got to do away with this demon weed because the white women will smoke it and they'll have sex with black men. And I know that, it really kind of falls back on when the founders when they wrote down we the people, the fact that they capitalized the letter people signified something that eludes people. People have a tendency to think that's because we were important. No, what it was saying is we the people was the people that signed that document, not we the common people. That's why it's capitalized, little legal ease that they pulled over on people. So people wonder why, the Constitution, no one's upholding it. It's because it only protects the very wealthy. That's it. Nobody else. Everybody else is their subjects. But on the Ukraine thing, because a lot of people are, I know that there's a lot of misinformation on the Ukraine thing, that Putin's some kind of monster. And, just in my brief little look at the isms of the world, I believe that any of the isms, well, most of them, a good percentage of Marxism, socialism, communism, all of these things have been demonized. And that if it were not for ultimate power bringing about ultimate corruption, all of these programs would work very well for the whole world. We could live at peace. There's no wrong idea. The corruption is the wrong idea. But the thing with Ukraine was that I think should be, really looked at is that when Victoria Nuland, there was a clip of her bragging about how she had dumped her and her friends, her cohorts, had put $5 billion into Ukraine, supposedly to support democracy, when in fact, the thugs that overthrew that government, the youth, the Nazi youth that overthrew the government there, were being paid by these people $50 a day. And, they were in economic stress, though, just like here, everybody's struggling. because the IMF wants everything. It wants everything. And anyway, so in that little YouTube clip where she's talking about that, clearly right behind her is an Illuminate logo of Chevron. And there seems to be some talking on The Guardian. Naomi Klein, the Americans' oil companies and interests want to get into Ukraine to frack it. Evidently, there's a lot of money to be made, and there's a lot of oil and everything like that. So rather than we have to remember that all of these major events that are going on, it's none of it is any moral high ground. America does not stand on a moral high ground. As a matter of fact, in the last 60 years, we've gone from number one in popularity to number one in fear. We're the most likely country to create war and to involve itself in war. The number one. So,
well, you put a lot of stuff out there on the table, Dan, for people to feast on today.
Anyway, it's just a delight, and I want to thank you so much. It's just wonderful to hear your voice, and I look forward in months to go by to where I can ask you some questions, because I find you just totally enchanting, and your thought process.
I'm moving to Shasta in the morning.
Well, thank you, Therese.
Thank you, Dan, for your contribution.
On being the beautiful person you are. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, from Dallas, what have you to say, Sister Sarah?
Well, greetings to you, Therese, and greetings to the PRN audience.
Thank you. Same to you.
Yes, ma'am, and I wish everyone an enjoyable weekend and do something fun out there. What I wanted to free my mind on, Therese, that piece that you played on yesterday with the women's movement, and I was going to do that for my clear my mind, but you have cleared it for me on Thursday, so I don't have that much on my mind this Good Friday to let off.
Well, that's an exception so far. You usually
yes,
have quite a bit on your mind.
Yes, because you helped me to decompress, because after I listened to that piece, with all of that fluff, because I was going to say the same thing. I said, this sounds to me like more baloney, because they're talking about this pay thing, because I knew it was a strategic move made, because it's like, I wish that you would get, if you could book and get Professor Ian Heine Lopez that wrote his new book to talk about dog whistles.
Yes.
If you
Ian
can get him
Lopez
on.
And I go back quite a way. As one of his most important books, I think, is called White by Law,
yes,
in which
yes,
he traces
yes.
the rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court and
yes.
Its race-related decisions. Yes.
Yes, I've read his book, and his new book on dog whistle policies, and you were going through
mm-hmm.
that. I said, Professor Heine Lopez would be a good guest for you to bring on to go through this, because this is what that was all about yesterday, because they're going to set up this good cop, bad cop routine, that which is what they're doing with this bill. They knew it was going to fail, but they did it on a grand scale in public to show, you see what? This is what the Republicans have done. You see, you can't trust them. This is why y'all need to come out and vote. This is why y'all need to get them out of office, because they are blocking the Democrats at every block. They're not letting them do these things. This is these poor women trying to get salary, and this is what they did. Seven of them, we're going to publish their names. We're going to show what they did, who voted it down, and y'all need to come out and y'all need to get these sevens. Y'all need to get them out of office. This is all played on emotion. This is what it was geared up to do. It is geared up to keep the black people who are strictly on the Democratic team, keep them on there so that you would run out to the poll and you would pull everything with a D, and everyone who are sitting out there on the fringe with the Republicans, you're going to put another nail into their coffin. And once again, as you said, with Hillary Clinton out here in the wing, and maybe Elizabeth Warren, who might be a competition for her if they talk her into also getting on the ticket for 2016, this is what this is gearing up to. This is gearing up to be another women's thing. Us women, we need to rally the women. We need to get on out here. We need to get on the ticket. Even though, as you said, because I look at that picture, The only person black that I saw there was Eleanor Holmes Norton. Everybody else sitting around the president, they all did not look, you didn't see no Latino, no Asian, none of them. It was all white women surrounding this president. He was only him and Eleanor Holmes Norton. So they always like to say, this is just why I always come back, you treats, and they always say that when people always try to tell me about women's issue and what it is they're trying to do, I always want to see who is on the board, who is the spokesperson, what it is that you want me to do. Because I know it's going to be another one of these use situation scenarios where you want to use me as a face to say, yeah, you see what? We got blacks too, because here she is. We have this one black person. Put me out there for everything else so people would think there's a whole bunch of blacks behind me when there isn't any. I'm just the face that they're using.
Well, it's a very cynical thing to do because it does damage to a couple of really important things that could be done in this period. You know, if people were honest and if they really assessed how they too are being used. I mean, Barbara mm-hmm. Mikulski, you heard from her passion yesterday, is quite taken with this issue. And yet, I mean, I really believe she is 100% sincere. However, the question has to be raised, what has been the role of women leaders within the Democratic Party?
Exactly.
You know, how is it that all this time they played along with what the men, the Democratic men had said? These are the priorities of what where we ought to go. And all these anti-human things that had been occurring all this time, we don't see any opposition. And the women have not made a definitive and qualitative difference, certainly not loudly. You know, you have a person like, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who Barack Obama is absolutely committed mm-hmm. to returning to her, quote, leadership in the House, saying offensive things like, we don't have to explain what's in the bill. Vote for it first, and then we'll tell you what's in
mm-hmm.
it. You have, you know, women going along with and not really calling the party to account for things like the cuts and going along with the cuts as a so-called compromise on food stamps. The president's, I should say, the education secretary's assault on public education, the massive opposition to Common Core, which continues despite the fact that the educators are saying this is really a bad thing. We shouldn't really go this way.
We don't even have to go that far back, you trees. We only have to go to see how they treated Hillary Clinton. They treated her like a rock star. Look what this woman did, and she went and she completely destroyed Libya. She's out here on the stage now running off at the mouth about what's going on in the Crimea and the Ukraine. You know, they want, to me, it's always been about white women and white men having a power struggle, and they don't care who they trample. It's like when an elephant is having a fight. They don't care how the grass get trampled, and nobody cares because they're having their fight. And that's what it is, a power struggle between them, and they're going to use whatever it is by any means to see what they have to do and use you in the process to see who's going to come out on top. Because Nancy Pelosi, she's a millionaire seven times over, just like Dianne Feinstein, just like all of them. Their husbands, they have big money that they're making out there in California. These people act as if though this is their birthright, that they whatever these titles, these positions, is something that's given to them by them being white and female. They're supposed to hold it, and they're just as unethical as the men that they are representing.
That's
so
my
all
point.
Of this talk about
that is
people,
my point right there. You know, it's time for people to become accountable and not to be manipulated on the basis of emotion. And it was very upsetting, I think, to hear Mikulski talk about, well, when we need to do these things, people say we are emotional, you know, to yield to that stereotypical view at the same time that you try to affirm your power seems incongruous to me. But, you know, The most important thing I wanted to achieve was to bring a different focus to this thing. It's not that, you know, there aren't problems that need to be solved. And nobody, of course, would want to have to endorse that women should make mm-hmm. less money than men. But that's not the argument. It really isn't.
Excuse me, I don't mean to lag you or cut you off. Because Utrecht, I'll say, I used to be a member of the union that I used to be a member of, and I just finally I had to get out of it. Because in unions that I've noticed that I've been involved with, is that it's always black women, black men, then you get Latino women, Latino men, and then, of course, white women and white men. They're always the last to form and join up in the unions. But if you look in the unions that I've always been in, the majority of membership have always been black and Latinos, but the leadership have always been white women and white men running these organizations. They're the least amount in members, but they always are up there running it and always want to be in charge of it, and they're always getting on the side of management, which is one reason why I said to hell with it. I told them, cut out my membership, do not take out any more donations from my salary. I'm not going to be a part. If I can't defend myself and your union can't defend me, to hell with it.
Amen. Thanks, Sarah, for calling. You will have a good weekend, wouldn't you? 888-874-4888. It is your time to talk up and say what's on your mind and to share some ideas of things that we should consider. We might have missed a thing or two, things that you think warrant a closer look. 888-874-4888. That's the whole point. Don't let media make your mind up. You know, just think independently. And when you start asking the questions, like, again, you look at the room. The president is signing something that is supposed to be of enormous impact. And we look at the room. And as you look at the room, just that alone tells you who is being served, whose interests are being paid attention to. And we should reject these things, I mean, fiercely reject them, publicly reject them, say, no, this is not my standard. And if women are going to be held as the change that is supposed to come to the political system, but they're behaving just as badly as the system, or in some cases even worse than the system, we need to call this out, and they need to feel the fire, because in the end, their positions to make these enormous decisions are fueled by the votes of people like you and me. But of course, I told you, I stopped voting 13 years ago. I no longer do. And I will vote if there is a reason, if I see a really clear reason to vote, I will vote. But I can't participate in this charade. This is not the way it's supposed to be. And certainly, I will not insult myself, and I won't insult the importance of the vote by casting it upon these undeserving people. I will not invest in my own annihilation. I'm just not going to do it. So until there is a reason to vote, until there is a candidate, and not just a candidate, but a program that is credible, until there is a system that is decidedly different from me as a voter, being told in so many words, here is the person we have chosen for you to vote, vote into office. We've done the due diligence. All you have to do is to follow our lead and take your cues from us, and you'll be all right. We have decided that candidate A is the person that you should vote for. And then we show up like lemmings and, disengage our brain and perform like a robot, the pre-programmed format. And then we go home, supposedly feeling really good about the fact that we have done our democratic duty and we are part of the democratic process. We're too sophisticated for that. We're too old for this, these old silly tricks. And it's time to take a stand. You know, somebody had written saying, well, you know, we should just leave. And I said, that's a good idea, but don't just leave. We have to aggressively leave. We have to loudly leave the process. Don't just slink off into the night. What they are afraid of is people challenging the system to be accountable. And when you get out in a public way and you say, I refuse to associate myself with this putrid process, I refuse to be part of it. Instead, I'm going to do this. That really begins a chain reaction that they will worry about. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, Idris. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Well, you know, last time I was on, I was saying that, well, we maybe should get rid of the politicians. And now I hear that... that you also feel that the politicians are unworthy, and therefore you haven't voted for so many years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel the same way, but I'm not as diligent as you. I go over there and pull some lever or other. And I just
I found myself doing that.
I just think it's because I'm numb, you know.
We are conditioned.
I'm not thinking. I'm unaware. So I just go over there like a donkey maybe, or you know, some beast of burden, and I pull this, you know, chain over there because it's the better of two evils. And we spoke about that with Dr. Gillespie. And it does. We don't have a choice. We're not, you know, everything. In our politics, it seems like there's a big funnel, you know, and you start, you know, with all this stuff on the periphery, and then it funnels down to a very, very narrow, narrow, tiny, tiny tube, and something drops out of the bottom of that tube, and it's nothing like anybody, you know, considered voting for, you know, but then...
Well, I'll tell you what did it for me. I mean, I looked at a choice, I looked at a category I was supposed to vote on as a good citizen, and it was for a judgeship. Now, how am I to know who is the best judge? How am I to judge the judge? You know, they don't campaign, they're prohibited actually from campaigning, but yet people are supposed to elect them. Based on what?
Right.
You just have a name. So basically, here I am as a person who I think, you know, reasonably sane. And I have no idea who I might be voting for. And yet, you know, you customarily just go and you make a decision on the basis of, do you like the person's name?
It's a beauty contest of sorts.
Does it sound like a nice name?
Well, you're being very honest, and me too. I mean, why do I vote? I guess we feel that, you know, we're conditioned to do this because, you know, we're shamed into doing it.
Yeah.
Actually, there's shame involved. I think that's it.
Actually, you know what it is, to be very, very honest, it is the success of the advertising principles, how you affect people's minds, how you could influence their conduct, how you could predict outcomes by basically conditioning people to accept the abnormal as normal. And there I was. I said, I am not doing this. I walked out. I said, I am not doing this.
Well, I respect you tremendously for that. You know, and I feel remiss because I've been doing this for years, and I've been feeling the way you feel, you know, but nevertheless, I do it. So,
yeah.
So I have to reconsider all of that.
I'm glad about it because it's not just, for me, it's not just leaving the process. It's also about saying, let's do something else, and being loud about it. We have had this problem with really bad leadership, but we tolerate it in silence. We have to be very, very vocal about it. And, you know, this is one of the things that I said way back when Jesse Jackson was running, that we should have publicly canceled his contract, you know, pronounce him publicly as a person who no longer qualifies for leadership, considering that from 1984 to took him only 4 years to be a complete and total traitor. He was in 1984. It was very promising because he brought all these groups, mobilized all these groups, energized all these groups the way Obama did. And as an insurgent, was doing a magnificent job of getting people's imagination fired up about the possibility of a different kind of leadership. And it took 4 years, and by 1988, he was a full-fledged hostage of the Democratic Party.
And just ruined
the Rainbow Coalition. And we never publicly chastised him for that. So he knows that, you know, he disappointed all these people, and the people know that he was a great disappointment, but there was no public pronouncement of it. And this is what is important. We have to remove ourselves from systems that are ineffective and pronounce it publicly that we are canceling our contract with them or their contract with us.
Right.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks so much for today. Donald on leadstories@gmail writes, the big news here in Atlanta is the revelation that Sharpton's admission that he spied on the mafia for the FBI. I think he spied on others. Is it news there? Well, I did say that story goes all the way back to the 1980s. At the time, I was an editor of the newspaper of the City Sun, and we subjected him to a great deal of scrutiny around this question. At the time, he explained, first of all, he denied it. There were rumors, I mean, they were swirling all over the place by the activist community who had suspicions and by leaders who had credibility within the community who had suspicions. But then Sharpton came forward and said, yes, he was wearing a wire, but it was a part of his program to rid the African-American community of the stranglehold of drug dealers and people basically in organized crime. At the time, he was conducting door-to-door programs, you know, lots of media attention. He would go up to a building and mark it as a drug spot that needs to be gotten rid of. But, you know, this is a very dicey thing because now he says it was for the mafia. At the time, we were told that he was doing this to help the police to identify those drug dispensing or drug dealing operations that were causing a steep decline in the quality of life in black neighborhoods. The question still looms, and we should know one way or the other. But that goes back to mid-80s, actually, early 80s to mid-80s. These were huge questions in the African-American community in Brooklyn about the Reverend Alfred Sharpton. I don't know whether it is or isn't true that he was spying on others. I can tell you that that was a very heavy suspicion by many in the African-American community in a leadership position. I don't know that, as a leader, the usual thing was that people would be spying on the leaders, not that the leaders would be spying. But then again, when you look at the history of African-American movements, you see that this essential element was an integral part of controlling the political progress of communities, especially by people or organizations seen to be in opposition to the status quo. It was one of the principal ways in which most all African-American movements were destroyed. They were destroyed from within by people spying and reporting to various federal agencies and local law enforcement agencies, and you know, it was stunning. This destroyed the Garvey movement. It destroyed the Panthers. It destroyed SNCC. It destroyed even King's movement had this element within it. To this day, the question still remains, who was responsible for bringing Dr. King out on the landing at that particular time? There was somebody within his group who was assigned the duty to bring him out there within clear view of his assassin or assassins. So these questions haven't been properly answered or even addressed. So we see this element within black movements, and not just black movements, within all movements. There are usually people from within whose job it is to just disrupt and destroy. It's happening with Pacifica. It has happened with Pacifica. You think people with all this intelligence would behave differently, but that's not the case at all. They are reporting to other authorities, being promised all kinds of goodies. I'm just hoping that Reverend Sharpton will address this in a substantive way, and not on the television, not on MSNBC. This is not something that belongs there. Come to the community and deal with it there, because that is where it started and that is where the effect was most directly felt. So that's the answer, Donald, for the time being. Yes, this was a major issue. We reported it openly and consistently. There are leaders of the community who still have issues with it, and to a certain degree, it even arose in the Tawana Brawley case. This was a big issue, even within the Tawana Brawley case, that there may have been people who were close to the nucleus of this case who were actually working against it, sharing information with law enforcement and whoever else. And you see the effect it had. It was 30 years of pain and torture for everyone involved in this case when it didn't have to be. So these are questions that still remain pertinent to just getting some clarification from Al Sharpton. Thank you for your question. All right, we have DX from L.A.
Hello, Yatrice. How are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you.
Good, good. I was thinking yesterday when you were talking about the signing of that legislation. And I was thinking just now when Harvey, I believe he was, the last caller, was talking.
Oh, that's Michael.
Was that Michael? Okay.
Yeah.
And I just think the whole political process, whole politics in this country, electoral process is just so much of a farce. And when he was talking, it just brought to mind that the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. I mean, like he said, I don't know why we do it, but we just keep voting. You know, so we keep doing the same thing over and over expecting a different result. That's the definition of insanity. So what you were saying about the legislation yesterday, You were absolutely right. This is just a dog and pony show. It's a kind of a game they play to fight for power. It's mm-hmm. like you know, it's the Gambinos versus the, you know, the, it's the old
Genovese type of thing.
Right. It's like, okay, well, we're going to show you up because we're going to point out who's blocking this and who's blocking that. When the whole system is set up, and this is what I was, some of the things I was talking about with Professor Gillespie a few, a couple of days ago, is that, first of all, this, I'll give you a couple examples. The Senate, like I pointed out, two, they were put there obviously to stop any kind of progressive legislation because what they're saying is, okay, we know traditionally our major cities with all the people in are traditionally the more progressive, more liberal thinking areas, right? I mean, it makes sense. So the idea that two votes from Idaho, two votes from South Dakota, and two votes from North Dakota, which elects these right-wing people who don't want to touch anything progressive. I mean, the idea they can turn something back that most of the people in the country want is just ridiculous. And then you got the Electoral College system. Makes no sense. I won't even go into that. So from top to bottom, it's just a scam. We've been scammed into voting and thinking that it's going to do some good. We've been scammed for a long time. And you know what happened to me last night? I had a dream. I had a dream that we had a revolution. Not a violent one. It was actually quite peaceful. I woke up with a smile on my face. We told all the bums to get out. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. I mean, so that's what we need. You know, I called in a few days ago, and I made the statement that we need self-governance. And I think people kind of take that the wrong way sometimes because I believe it was Allie, I think she's in New York.
Yes.
She said that she heard people talking about self-governance and how are we going to do that when the police come out every time we protest. See, that's a wrong understanding of what self-governance, what I meant by self-governance, because if, of course, protesting for a few reasons doesn't do us any good, okay? The entrenched interests in Washington have so much money that now it's getting to the point where the representatives and the senators don't even care what the people want. They will ignore you. They will just do everything they can to not do what it is that the people want because the other side is giving them money. So Allie, bless her heart, I mean, no disrespect to her, but when I said self-governance, I didn't mean protesting. What I meant was there needs to be a revolutionary change in the way we do things in our political system. We need to govern ourselves, have a true democracy. Now, that's not going to happen in this present system, okay? I was involved, well, I went out several times to the Occupy movement in Los Angeles and in Long Beach. And so a few observations I had at that time, this was a couple of years ago, I think, or a year and a half ago, was that, first of all, there's not enough people here, okay? If we get together in such numbers, you know, do you know how many people were in the March on Washington, the original with Dr. King?
Well, the estimate was in excess of 500,000.
Right, exactly. So I go out to the Occupy movement in Los Angeles, large metropolitan area, one of the biggest cities in the United States, and there's only about 2,000 people out there. You know, and this huge, it's a huge park downtown, 2,000 people. Of course they can bring the police in and shut you down, as Allie was saying. They're always going to do that because one rule they have is what might makes right. We got the guns, we got the billy clubs, we're going to come in and we're going to shut you down, of course. But can you imagine them trying to do that to 2 million people? How many cops they're going to have? What can they do? They really can do nothing. That's too much for the system to handle. So that's one point. And by the way, I was shocked at how few black people were out there, too. I mean, that's a whole other subject. And I mean, I think I know what the reason for that is. But, okay, I went up to these Occupy movements, I've also gone to other awareness type conferences and you know, even handing out flyers for the, when they were trying to get this, well, recently they're trying to get this standard passed in California for fracking and stuff like that, especially in the Long Beach area and all that. So I've been out to do these things, and literally, I mean, you can count the number of people on your hands. You know, a few years ago I went out to a protest in front of, I believe it was, which was it, Cigna Healthcare, or one of those, which wasn't giving the liver transplant to the lady whose daughter was in hospital in Glendale, California. And, I mean, this huge building, and then there were only about 100 people outside. You know, this is, and this was a national case. People knew about this. I mean, so this is, you know, this is what I'm saying. That's why we're not affected. It's because we don't have the numbers, and we need to find some kind of way of waking people up. And self-governance doesn't mean go protest. What it means is, because protesting is begging. Please, won't you do this? We really want this. We really, you know, we need a revolution. And after the revolution becomes evolution. Okay? Now, nobody's talking violence. It's just that when you get out in the streets and millions of, well, let's say we have 5 million people from all over the country who are just fed up. And we just all get together in two or three locations. They got 1.5 million people to deal with in every location. I mean, this is saying something. This is saying, you know, we're not taking this anymore, and there's no way you're going to stop us, and we're going to force what we want, whether you want to do it or not. You know, stop buying their food, stop going to work. Oh, well, can't stop going to work, I guess. I guess you got to work. But, I mean, stop participating in the system as if we are going to have some kind of miraculous change with things the way they are. Because as it stands, people don't even know how to vote an effective person because they're lied to so much. They get on the TV with these advertisements and all they do is lie. So people buy it. They buy that and then they go vote for the person and then the next thing you know, oh, well, they didn't do what we thought we were going to do. That's because we're trusting in the system as it exists. And another thing is we have to stop thinking about what we cannot do. We have to say we can change this. You know,
well, you know, DX, here's the thing. It's not that the absence of people means that they're not interested or they're apathetic. It is, I get a sense, and I'm giving a kind of reason here for it, I get a sense that people feel so overwhelmed. It's a very psychological thing. And the process of reawakening that spirit of activism in people is you have to give them a reason. You have to really speak to them and to encourage them to drop back into this notion of you help us to fix what's wrong.
Right.
So this is why I say about the new parties and the parties that do exist, the other than Republican and Democratic parties that exist, need to do a huge job about this. They need to come into these distressed communities and present themselves as workable alternatives. And other new parties need to spring up like crazy. We need a multiplicity of parties so that the conversation is occurring at just about every level. Everybody has something that they can relate to as an interest. And it revives the political will. It provides a political awareness and a consciousness. People literally have been deadened, scientifically deadened, to be automatons, not fully thinking people. And that a lot of money went into that. Millions and millions of dollars went into doing this scientific job of deadening the mind and deadening the will to fight. So we have to recognize that as a real issue. This process yielded a nation of automatons just show up and vote,
right,
or people who just said, ah, the heck with it, but without going any further, taking that political will in a different direction, a more productive direction. So it's education.
Absolutely.
That's the
and
main
I would
thing.
I would agree with that. And the last point that I would want to make is that we have a lot of work to do here. This is, and that's another reason a lot of people are probably not involved as much as they should be, is because this is work. This is a whole lot of work. And then with your actual job and your family and things like that,
mm-hmm,
people have a lot on their plate. But this
mm-hmm
is work. This is a lot of work. But we can do it. I mean, you know, we can do it, but it's a lot of work. So
yes.
Anyway, Eutrice, I know your show is ending. I'll let you have the last couple of minutes to express your thoughts. I won't...
Well, everybody's done a great job. I like this process of having a boiling cauldron going in which we put our own little flavors in this wonderful soup. I really do enjoy it. And I think it is necessary work in helping us reconstitute and revitalize our political consciousness, which will inform, hopefully, our political actions. Thanks so much for being with me today. You want to stay tuned for Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, which comes right behind me. And I'd love to hear from you, leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know what you're thinking. And thank you so much for the privilege and the honor of your company.
Shake your head like you don't care.